What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Homer Hickam Jr. Now, you may be familiar with Homer Hickam. Homer is a lot of things. He is a U.S. Army veteran. Mr. Hickam served as a first lieutenant in the 4th Infantry Division in Vietnam from 1967 to 1968, where he won the Army Commendation and Bronze Star Medals. He served 6 years on active duty, leaving the service with the rank of captain. In 1998, Delacorte Press published Hickam's second book, Rocket Boys, a memoir, the story of his life in the little town of Colwood, West Virginia. It became an instant classic. Rocket Boys has since been translated into 8 languages and also released as an audiobook and an ebook. In February 1999, Universal Studios released its critically acclaimed film October Sky, based on Rocket Boys. The title October Sky, by the way, is an anagram of Rocket Boys. Delacorte Press subsequently released a mass-market paperback of Rocket Boys retitled October Sky, and October Sky reached the New York Times #1 position on their bestseller list. While working on his writing career, Mr. Hickam was employed as an engineer for the U.S. Army Missile Command from 1971 to 1981, assigned to Huntsville, Alabama, and in Germany. He began employment with NASA at the Marshall Space Flight Center in 1981 as an aerospace engineer. During his NASA career, Mr. Hickam worked in spacecraft design and crew training. His specialties at NASA included training astronauts on science payloads and extravehicular activities, also known as EVA. He also trained astronaut crews for many space lab and space shuttle missions, including the Hubble Space Telescope deployment mission, the first two Hubble repair missions, Space Lab J, where he trained the first Japanese astronauts, and the Solar Max repair mission. Prior to his retirement in 1998, Mr. Hickam was the payload training manager for the International Space Station program. We discuss all this and more. It was a great pleasure speaking with him. And now I give you Homer Hickam. Okay, I'm here with Homer Hickam. Homer, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Josh.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. This is a conversation I've been wanting to have for a long time in many ways. I've been looking forward to this since you and I first corresponded a few weeks ago. You know, on the off chance that we have any listeners that might not be familiar with you, I'm just curious if you could please tell our audience who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm Homer Hickam, and I'm probably best known for writing a memoir titled Rocket Boys that was made into the movie October Sky, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, who played me in the film. I am a writer for many, many years. I've got 19 books published so far. Many of them are bestsellers. I have a background of working for NASA. I worked for NASA for 20 years and trained astronauts. For that, I'm a Virginia Tech graduate. I'm a Hokie. I grew up in Colwood, West Virginia, a mining town. And I'm a Vietnam veteran. And so I think that kind of sums up who I am.
Oh, excellent. Thank you, Homer. I appreciate that. I'd love for you kind of drawing the clock back a little bit, Homer, if you could speak a little bit about Colwood. Is it true that the town was actually owned by the coal company?
Colwood was a pure company town, Josh. The coal company owned every house, every tree, every road, every fence. It owned every store. Every man who lived in Colwood had to work for the coal company since all the houses were rented out by the coal company. The coal company even owned the churches. There were 2 churches in town, owned both of them. Preachers were company men. They towed the company line. They preached the company sermon. So, yeah, I would say the coal company owned Colwood.
Wow, that's extraordinary. What was it like growing up there?
Well, it was good in a lot of ways. I grew up with kids, all of whom, their parents were involved with the coal company. Their dads were coal miners. Their moms were the wives of coal miners. So we had a lot in common. And we knew each other practically from the day we were born. We were allowed to be outside and play any way we wanted to play. We'd go up in the mountains and we'd play you know, cowboys and Indians and all of that stuff, and jump off cliffs and break our arms and our heads and everything else. We tended to get in a little bit of trouble. Our moms especially knew everything that we did long before we got home, and they were ready to let us know about it when we got home. But we knew that over time that our fathers worked in a very dangerous profession. And throughout my life there as a kid in Colwood, a number of good friends, their dad was either killed or injured in the mine. And the rule was in Colwood that if the father was, of course, had been killed in the mine or was such that he could not work in the mine, then the family had to leave Colwood. And we lost the company house because the company needed another family into that house. They usually were given a little while, you know, a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months in some cases, but ultimately they had to leave Colwood. So it tended to be sometimes a pretty serious place.
Wow, that's extraordinary. Thank you, Homer. Yes. So, you know, the movie October Sky, of course, based on your book, Rocket Boys, you know, which we'll get into later, depicts Jake Gyllenhaal as you being inspired to take up rocketry after seeing Sputnik in the October Sky. And I'm curious, how it was depicted in the movie what actually happened, or was there some dramatic license taken?
Well, I mean, Hollywood has its ways, you know, with the telling of the story, but they were pretty close on the boy watching Sputnik. The way that happened, and the way I wrote about it in the book, was that I was not particularly interested in science or space or anything like that, although I'd read a lot of science fiction. I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. But when I read in the paper that this thing that everybody in the world was talking about, Sputnik, the world's first Earth satellite that the Russians had launched, it scared the United States and everybody so much because we weren't able to do the same thing. It was being talked about everywhere. But then I read in the paper that Sputnik was actually going to fly over Colwood, which was just an amazing thing for me, because to us in that little coal town, little isolated coal town, it was like everything in the world happens in the world, but we're different. We're kind of isolated from all that. But here it was, the thing that everybody was talking about was actually going to fly over Colwood. So I told my mom that I was going to go out in the backyard and watch Sputnik fly over that night. And that so impressed her, she walked across the yard and told the neighbor lady, Mrs. Sheritz, that Sonny, as I was called back then, was going to watch Sputnik that night. And Mrs. Sheritz crossed the yard and told Mrs. Mahoney, who crossed the yard and told Mrs. McLaughlin. I can name all these families all the way down. So that's the way news spread in Colwood, was fence line to fence line. Somewhere along the line, I think the message got muddled. It was like, you can only see Sputnik in the Hickams' backyard. So come the time to do it, our backyard was just filled with people back there to help me watch Sputnik. And my dad, who was a mine superintendent, walked out on the porch and said, Elsie, why are all these people in our backyard? And she said, well, they've come to help Sonny watch Sputnik. And he said, well, they can all just go home. I just can't believe President Eisenhower would never allow anything Russian to fly over Colwood. So he put on his hat, went up to the mine, didn't look up. But Eisenhower, unfortunately, was not in charge of the laws of physics. And here came Sputnik. And back then, there was no light pollution, especially in a little town like that. So our skies were extremely dark and very clear. And it just so happened that the way Sputnik flew, our mountains were really, really close together, but Colwood was in a long valley. And the way Sputnik flew was it just bisected that valley. So we got to see it for quite some time. And I have to say, if it had been God himself in a golden chariot flying over, I would not have been more impressed at that moment to see this thing, this amazing thing. And I knew at that moment, somehow, some way, I wanted to be part of what was obviously developing this great race into space.
Wow. That's incredible, Homer. Thank you. So I guess the one softball question I'll ask you, who were the Rocket Boys and how did you meet?
Well, there were actually six boys. In the movie, they showed four. And again, these were boys, for the most part, that I grew up with, knew my whole life. We got involved with all kinds of different things, and we liked to do them together. And so the other boys were not particularly interested in building rockets or working for, there wasn't even a NASA then, but whatever would develop there. But they just liked helping me out. They thought it was kind of fun to blow things up, you know. So the Rocket Boys were Roy Lee Cook, who his father actually died in a coal mine. He was one of the few that was allowed to stay in Colwood. His mom worked for the school as a cook. So she was allowed, and Raleigh was allowed to stay at Sherman Sears. Sherman had polio, but he just did everything he could with us. And in the movie, they combined two characters, Sherman with Odell. Odell was actually the garbage man's son. He was great because he could always find something that we could use in the garbage dump, or he was really good at finding ginseng, which we would sell in order to make some money to buy our rocket propellant. And Billy Rose, it was not in the movie. Billy was from a very, very poor family and actually lived up another hollow when his dad stopped working for the mine for one reason or the other. Then we had Quentin Wilson, who was the prototypical nerd of all time. Quentin was not a Coalwood boy. He was from a little place called Bartley, which was three mountains away. In West Virginia, we measure everything by mountains. How many mountains? He was three mountains away. And I didn't meet Quentin until I went to high school. And high school was two mountains away in a town called War, West Virginia, Big Creek High School. That was the district, Big Creek District. So these were schools from all these little mining towns, kids from the schools in these mining towns all came to this combined school. And so that's where I met Quentin. And Quentin was the most interesting character. He was simply a genius. There's no question about it. He had a vast vocabulary, which he tended to put on a fake British accent all the time. And so, you know, I was intrigued by Quentin quite a lot. And we brought him in because at first we didn't have much success building our rockets. And I thought Quentin, if there was anybody at Big Creek High School that know how to build a rocket, it'd be Quentin. So Quentin joined us. So I think that was, I've got all six of them there.
No, excellent. Thanks, Homer. Didn't Quentin say something to the effect of he didn't want to go to gym class because his brain was too big?
Or too heavy.
Actually. Too heavy.
Yeah, it's interesting. Quentin was not our valedictorian. He was our salutatorian. That's the second place. And the first place was actually my beloved Dorothy Plump, the girl that I lusted after through unsuccessfully throughout high school. Quentin was not the valedictorian because he got B's in phys ed. So
that's what's funny. Homer, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about designing those early rockets, how you got the machinists involved, and just the level of precision that it would take to build even these early iterations of the rockets.
Right. Well, to begin with, we had no clue how to build a rocket. And so we suspected that pointy end was up and where the flame came out was probably on the bottom. We had seen pictures in Life magazine of rockets, and that's all we had to go on. And so Quentin brought in knowledge that the Chinese 1,000 years ago had used black powder to build the rocket. So that's where we started. And almost immediately, I went up to a little machine shop there by the mine. There was a fellow by the name of Mr. Ike Bykovsky, who was the machinist there, and asked him, you know, what kind of materials could we use to build a rocket? And after some conversation, you know, he suggested the easiest thing he saw was aluminum tubing, wooden nose cone, and maybe some solder to put in like a washer or something at the bottom and solder on the fan. Well, he didn't know either. What we found out immediately was metallurgically, that's not really a good idea because this thing gets really hot and everything melts. You know? The solder is not going to help us very much. So it didn't take long going down to the main machine shop, working with Mr. Bolt down there and some of the other machinists. It didn't take us long to figure out steel would be better for us. And even though it's heavy, they had thin wall steel tubing that they used in the coal mine. And so it was a lot of trial and error and just looking at the pictures and the machinist helping us. And we graduated from black powder pretty quickly. It's pretty weak propellant, actually, to something that we called rocket candy. It was potassium nitrate and sugar that our teacher, Miss Riley, showed to us. And so we melted that, which is pretty dangerous, almost burned down our garage doing it. But anyway, it turned out to be a pretty powerful propellant that could get those, like, way too heavy steel rockets off the ground, but they did work. They didn't blow up. And so we got more sophisticated when Miss Riley got us a book about how to build rockets. And so it was a very professional book. I saw that book later on in a PhD program for rocket scientists, and it required a working knowledge of calculus and differential equations. And I was having trouble with algebra at the time. But we learned. And so that's when the rocket started getting sophisticated. It's like we're after about 2 years here. The movie compressed everything. So we're about 2 years in, a lot of trial and error, a lot of other things going on in our lives, but, you know, in terms of the rocket. So that's where we were. And it was clear by this book that we needed to figure out how to build a sophisticated rocket nozzle, which is a De La Valle rocket nozzle. You have intake and outtake, and it requires quite sophisticated machining to make that happen, plus calculations to figure out what the dimensions of the thing would be. So we were able, with Quentin's help, who knew calculus quite well, how to design and actually design these engines, but we weren't capable of machining them, but the machinists at the machine shop were. And they loved to sneak around and do this for us, even though my dad pretended he didn't know, of course. And so we graduated into a propellant we called Zinco Shine, which was zinc dust and sulfur with a alcohol binder. And this was a very, very powerful propellant and required a lot of sophistication to mix and to handle and figure out the specific impulse and to design the nozzle. And ultimately, we never totally solved some things about the nozzle in that it tended to erode. This was a very hot, high velocity exhaust out of this thing, but we worked on it to the end. In the end, we were getting up miles and miles into the sky.
So. Wow. That's incredible, Homer. Thanks for taking a few minutes on that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, as you might imagine, as you were talking, flashes of October sky were sort of reeling through my head. And I was thinking particularly about those wonderful scenes of the experiments that you guys did gone awry. The various explosions are always a sort of a viewer's favorite. I'm curious if there's a particular experiment that you guys did that went awry that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Well, yeah, I mean, we caused my dad some problems, and the movie was correct in that he never came down to see any of their launches until the very last one. And that was a very special time for me when he did that. And he was the one that actually gave us the Cape Colwood slack dump miles out of town. It was actually still on company property, but it was miles out of town, and that got us out of town, and it was a safer place for us to launch these rockets. But once, when the company had sent a fellow down, the steel company that actually owned us sent a fellow down, Mr. Fuller, to put a lot of pressure on Dad to increase production and lower cost and cut off people that he didn't want to do. My dad was trying to protect the town and trying to keep it going as best he could. And so that's when we chose to launch one of our rockets. And it actually, we did it in there was a high wind. We should have known better, blah, blah. And it went up, and it actually went into Colwood and came real close to hitting the church. And Mr. Fuller was surprised at that and put a lot of pressure on Dad about it and ordered our little blockhouse torn down and never to launch another rocket. And Dad took up, and he told us to keep going and resisted the steel company. So, yeah, it was a special time.
Wow. That's brave. That was brave of your father.
Yeah, well, Dan was a very brave man, needless to say. And again, he was under a lot of pressure at that time. The steel company had a lot of orders they were trying to fill, and the coal out of this deep coal mine was expensive compared to strip mining, which my dad hated, which is basically just going up and with a bulldozer and ripping the top off the earth and getting the coal out that way. A lot cheaper to do it that way. So our little coal town and his coal mine was in competition with that type of mining at the time. So he had a lot of stress on it.
Wow. Incredible. I'd love to talk a bit about that 1960 National Science Fair, Homer. Perhaps I'll phrase it this way. Can you talk about that nozzle being stolen at the fair?
Yeah, it really happened, just as they showed in the movie. I wrote about it in the book too. So here's what happened. The National Science Fair was up in Indianapolis, and which, when I got up there, I really felt uncomfortable because it was all flat. It was too flat. There were no mountains that I could see. And I just felt like I was just exposed. It just opened everything. And the other boys didn't go with me. It was just me. And even my teacher or parents were not allowed to go. We all went individually. Although when I got up there, I found that other students had brought their parents and their teachers and all that. But we didn't know any better. So I was up there all by myself, and we were, the ones that built the rockets were all kind of put off in one section. And I met a fellow there, a young boy from Texas, and he became kind of my helper there and looked out for me. And you know, he told me that I should lock my stuff up at night. And it's like, well, I don't understand it, because then I just have to put it up the next morning. And I just wasn't used to imagining that anybody would steal something, because where I was from, we didn't have the locks on our locker at school or anything. We just weren't used to that environment. And so I came in one morning, and this whole thing lasted a week. And so I came in like the second or third day, and the nozzles were gone. Somebody had stolen the nozzles, which were, you know, difficult to make. And I knew that when the judges came by, I really wouldn't have much to show them. And so I kind of panicked and got on the phone for the first time in the entire history of my life and made a long distance call and called back and asked my mom if he could do anything. And Dad was in the middle of a strike at that time. And again, under tremendous pressure. But he agreed to settle the strike, to let the machinist real quick fix his nozzles. And they put them on a Trailways bus and got them just in time before the judges came by.
That's an incredible story, Homer. Thank you.
Well, it was meant to be. You know, I've often said that things happen in my life for some reason so that I would have this story to tell, because it somehow ended up inspiring a lot of folks over the years. One of them was just simply working for NASA. I didn't work for NASA until I was 38 years old. Mm-hmm. And by then, again, a Vietnam War veteran, I was doing a lot of other things, and I'd pretty well given up on the idea of ever working for NASA. And just on a whim, I was over in Germany working for the Army at that time. And I, just for the fun of it, just so I'd have a letter showing that at least I had tried, you know, I wrote to NASA and ask them for a job. And lo and behold, they gave it to me. And that's just when the shuttle started to fly. And so I've often said that God let that happen so that I would have a good ending to Rocket Boys. I wouldn't have had it. I could tell the story about growing up in Colwood and building rockets all day long, but if it didn't have at the end of it, then hey, he had actually got a job with NASA at the end. So things had just worked out so that this story got out to the world.
Can be told. That's excellent. Well, you did some of the heavy lifting for me just then, Homer, because my next question, I wanted to ask you, what influenced your decision to join the military? And I'd love for you to be able to describe your military service.
Well, so my mom sent me off to Virginia Tech. I forgot to apply. I was busy with a science fair and everything else senior year, and I had no thought about college. And then all of a sudden, I realized I had not applied anywhere to go. We did not get, by the way, we didn't get scholarships like they showed in the movie. We all went to college one way or the other. I went on an Elsie Hickam scholarship. Okay. She saved enough money for me to go. So she chose where I went to school, and she chose Virginia Tech, which is a very tough engineering school. But at that time, it was also a military college. And so off I went, and not even realizing what kind of school it was and how tough it was, there I found myself wearing uniform, getting yelled at a lot. But I fell in line, and actually, I really liked my cadet corps years there. And of course, out of the other end of that, you're going to go into the military. So I ended up in the Army and ultimately as a lieutenant in the 4th Infantry Division over in Vietnam during the 67-68, during the Tet Offensive and all that kind of thing. So I kind of grew up over there in a lot of ways. And so that was my military experience. And when I came back, actually had a couple more years to fill. I was sent off to Puerto Rico as the reserve advisor down there, and that's where I learned to scuba dive and became a scuba instructor, and all of that happened. And so, again, I was very busy in my life. I wanted to be a writer, so I started freelance writing on the side. I wrote about scuba diving and diving on shipwrecks, and that ultimately led to my first book, which was called Torpedo Junction, which was the military history of the U-boat wars up and down the East Coast. And so that was a military history bestseller, but then I got really busy with NASA. I was over in Japan back and forth. I was training first Japanese astronauts and then the space station. So I just didn't have time to write that much, but I was still freelance writing, and I wrote a little article for Smithsonian Air and Space Magazine called The Big Creek Missile Agency, and that got so much attention. My phone practically melted down. New York published. We're calling and saying, are you going to write a book about this? And I said, well, I am now. And that's how I sat down, ended up writing the memoir, Rockin' Boys.
Ah, excellent. I know you gleaned at it a little bit earlier, Homer, but I'd love to just ask you directly, when did you join NASA?
I joined NASA in 1981. I was over in Germany. I was working for the Army over in Germany as an engineer, helping to really implement the first computerized management systems over there. And I'd taken one course at Virginia Tech on Fortran. I could write Fortran and on an old IBM 1620. And so I was over in Germany. I was doing a few things. It was kind of boring. And I heard that they wanted a management system. And I said, I know how to write a computer or to program a computer. And so they let me do it. And that's why NASA hired me, oddly enough. They wanted to have a management computer system at Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. That's why they hired me to come and do that. And so I grabbed it. The shuttle was just starting to fly. It was 1981. And I worked for about a year for the Space Lab program office. Space Lab was a laboratory, pressurized laboratory that went into the shuttle cargo bay that experiments were operated from. And so when I got that office program going, it was like, I really want to do something else. And by then I was working in the neutral buoyancy simulator, training the astronauts. I was, again, a scuba instructor. I was training the astronauts to do extra vehicular activities and that kind of thing. So I knew most of the astronauts that came up and did that kind of thing. And the Space Lab now started to fly, and they said, okay, we need training people, training managers to train the astronauts to work in the Space Lab. And I raised my hand and said, I can do that. And they let me. And so I became training manager for a number of Space Lab flights, and then later became the training manager for the new International Space Station.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you. This next question might end up being a little bit dumb. I might need your assistance in articulating it. But, you know, for non-engineers like myself, right, I'm curious, when you're in the process of designing a space shuttle, is there anything in particular that you're keeping in mind? What factors are you thinking about? I guess answer that however you'd like, Homer.
Well, I was not involved designing the space shuttle. Of course, it flew just as I came on. I later, the only really design that I was involved with was after Challenger. I was actually over in Japan when Challenger happened, and we were setting up the training of the first Japanese astronauts at that time. And everything was put off for, obviously, it's going to be years before we flew. And so I was brought back and asked to go on the solid rocket motor redesign team. And actually, I had not designed a solid rocket motor since 1960 at that point, but I did know enough of it. And they knew that I knew enough to participate in this. So we really, really dug into this thing, and we were really appalled at its design. And so, I mean, Quentin would have never designed a rocket like that, I can tell you. And so I guess I helped with a little Rocket Boys engineering on that to make it much tougher, much safer. And they did not ever have another failure with that solid rocket booster again. But I can tell you that, I mean, being part of the Space Lab program office and watching the engineers and being involved with the engineers who were designing that and seeing it built, there are just so many myriad components to it that have to be looked at. And so this was a pressurized spacecraft basically attached to the shuttle, and that ultimately became the basis for the modules that are now on the space station. So how do you best design them? What materials do you use? I mean, engineers have to work on that down to the last washer. You know, does this bolt require a washer on it or not? Can you do without it? Because especially in spaceflight, every ounce counts. And so the design has to be meticulous. And this is why what looks to be a pretty simple little thing, a pressurized chamber, ends up costing billions of dollars, because everything has to be looked at, tested to the nth degree in all kinds of situations, cold soak, heat soak, everything. And then in space, you got to think about off-gassing and all the different myriad things that normally we don't think about here when we're designing things on Earth. So it's a very, very specialized need for engineers when they design these things.
Oh, incredible. Thank you, Homer. Yeah, you mentioned it already. I would love to discuss your experience with Space Lab J. If my research was correct, you were the payload crew training manager. My understanding was you took on a couple different roles there. But what was it like training the first Japanese astronauts?
Oh, wonderful. Marvelous. They were fantastic. In the first place, they just love space. It was like the whole team over in Japan. I mean, they would ask me, Homer-san, what do you think about space? Why do you want to be in space? Why do you think we ought to go in space? And they were asking me questions that at NASA they never asked. They didn't care I can't. It's like, just design a thing or get this crew train or whatever. Just do your work. They did not get philosophical, but the Japanese did. They were very philosophical about why it was important to go into space and what we hope to find there, what we hope to do there. And they kind of opened it up for me in a lot of ways. So I went kind of in my mind back to when I was that boy in West Virginia and had these dreams, and had kind of been lost over the years with war and everything else. And now it came back to me. So I just absolutely loved working with them. I have a new memoir called Don't Blow Yourself Up, which you should buy for the title alone.
Yes, sir.
but in there, I tell about Space Lab J and some of the conflicts that we had that were really societal or philosophical between the American approach and the Japanese approach, and some of the conflicts that we had. I don't mention any names, but with our American astronauts who were just push ahead, do this, do that, get it all done real quick, where the Japanese were approaching this from a much more philosophical point of view and wanted to take a lot more time with their training and make it more educational than training and go back to the very basics of the science that we're trying, material science or life sciences, that we are the reason that we're building this experiment, as versus just here's the procedures. Do A, do B, do C, do D. And there was conflict between our two approaches on that. And of course, as a training manager, I'm caught in the middle of all that. So that makes for some interesting things to write about. I've often, one of the things that I did for all the space labs was the principal investigators, these scientists out at different places, different countries or different universities or businesses, organizations, they were the ones that were building the experiment. And so as a training manager, I want to get involved in it real early because I have to build a simulator to match that. And I'd go into their laboratories and they would have all of this sophisticated equipment all over the place like that and showing me their design, you know, how intricate it was. And this procedure, like 100 steps to take this metallic rod, whatever, and stick it in there, wait till it heats up to a certain temperature, turn this knob, push that button, make sure that valve is, and I'm going, stop. All right. So that's wonderful. And I'm sure that would work great. But let me tell you what the astronauts, what they want to see. And you try to get as close to that as you possibly can get. What they want to see is a box. It should have two buttons on it. One should say start, and the other one should say stop. That's it. So how close can you get to get to that? And you know, it's difficult, but they got it. Oh, okay, I gotta really simplify this thing because the astronauts are busy. They don't have time to come here and do all this stuff, you know, and learn all this stuff. And you want to make it as simple in orbit as you possibly. So yeah, it was interesting.
No, that's cool. You may have already answered it, Homer, but I tell you, I'd love for you to maybe talk a little bit about your, let's call it management philosophy, because I've listened to a bunch of your interviews in preparation for this, as you might imagine, and a common through line that I've found from you has been a deep love of teaching. I know you said that was one of the reasons why you wanted to be a scuba instructor, the idea of imparting an idea and making someone better. And I'm just curious what your general teaching or management philosophies might be, if you have any.
Well, yeah, I think in the first place, one thing about teaching is that you really have to learn your subject. You may think you know it, but you don't really know it until you have to teach someone. And so that means you've got to really peel the onion back on whatever subject that you're teaching. So the student knows whether you know what you're talking about, whether they've ever heard it before or not. They can just tell by your entire demeanor. So you have to immerse yourself in the subject before you teach, and you have to stand up with authority. You also have to make it interesting. It is on you, no matter what it is, no matter how dry and boring it is, to put some thought into it and make it an interesting teaching and learning experience and engage the student as much as you possibly can. Somewhat Socratic, I guess, where you ask questions, but you do so in such a way that elicits an answer that illuminates your class. So yeah, I really, really put a lot of thought in it. And I had, you got to realize in some cases what we were doing with the astronauts were, these were scientists who were not teachers, who were brought out and, you know, teach these astronauts, especially over in Japan. I ran into this, and they really didn't have that capability to intrigue these men and women as much as they should. So I had to jump in there and kind of, okay, we need to, you know, first make it a little, let's speed it up just a little bit, but let's also make it interesting to them so they don't fall asleep or whatever that they're doing. So yeah, I guess I've got a number of philosophies. A lot of that was brought out in a couple of different ways. Of course, being an Army lieutenant, you learn pretty quickly that you've got to motivate your men. You've got to show some authority. I just basically would fall back on some of my dad's ways of leadership, which were pretty tough, but they worked in the Army. Didn't necessarily work in a place like NASA. And NASA, you're a part of a team. No matter, even if they say you're the manager of this team, you're still a component of that team, and you don't go around telling people what to do ever. You'd never do that. You elicit cooperation. You put forth your idea on how to do this and bring the group together and make them want to do it. You know, so yeah. So there's a lot of philosophies, I guess, flowing through my head about education.
Sure. That could be a whole other podcast, right?
Yeah.
I'd love to know, what was it like working? Is it true that you worked on the deployment of the Hubble telescope? Did I get that right?
The deployment and the repair. So worked with Kathy Sullivan and Bruce McCandless. They were the astronauts who deployed the Hubble. And we did that for a couple of years in anticipation. Again, everything got pushed off by Challenger. And so we started in a neutral buoyancy simulator. We had a one-to-one mock-up of the Hubble Space Telescope, practically down to the last screw and washer. And so it was very accurate. And Kathy and Bruce were not actually scheduled to do an EVA, but it was a, like, if you need to have an EVA. So we trained them. Folks from Goddard actually were responsible for the Hubble, with Marshall as part of that, but it was mostly Goddard. So the Goddard people came down with all the procedures on how to deploy, manually deploy the Hubble if it needed to be manually deployed. And that those were the procedures that we used. And I went in the suit. Quite a few of us engineers would go into the suit. We'd go through these procedures, see how they worked, and then get it all confirmed. Then the astronauts would come up and change it all. Of course they do. That's what they do. But anyway, that was all done. So as it turned out, the Hubble did, when it went up, it did need some EVA. One of the solar panels didn't deploy, so, which was naturally the one thing that we didn't practice very much. But
of course, right?
Right. So Kathy and Bruce went out and deployed that. But then we found out, of course, a couple of weeks later, that the Hubble was nearsighted. And so almost instantly, all of us divers there at the neutral buoyancy simulator went, oh boy, we're going to have a great job here. I mean, everybody else has their long face and morose and sad and everything. We're going, hey, this could be good. So the Goddard guys figured out how to fix it and came up with all their procedures. And then once again, we went into the suits. One of the things, and then Story Musgrave came up. Story and Kathy Thornton, Jeff Hoffman, they were the crew that were going up and repair it the first time. And Story, of course, you could tell a million stories about Story, quite the guy. And he had at that time a friend that he really admired, and her name was Dorothy Hamill, the figure skater. Well, figure skater. And Dorothy Hamill had told Story that she never did any of her routines, even in practice, except unless it was end to end. She never did part of it. She did the whole thing. And this somehow got into Story's head. So he came up to Marshall and we all sat around and he said, we're going to do end to end tests. That's it. Well, great, Story, but that's like 6 hours. And you're going to be underwater for 6 hours. No problem. We can handle it. Well, yeah, you can't really, because the tank's 40 feet deep and you have the decompression problem here. And so you're actually underwater 5 PSI, more of an ambient, 5 pounds per square inch, more of an ambient, which is what the pressure in the suits were, which means in a couple of hours, you're going to have a lot of nitrogen diffused into your blood where you're going to have to decompress for a long time if you stay underwater that long. So Story says, well, we don't have time to do that, so you figure it out. So basically, they kind of invented a gas there called nitrox, which is used a lot by scuba divers now, which is, has a higher concentration percentage of oxygen in it, which is fine, except the Marshall engineers who were designing all this, it occurred to them that maybe you might catch on fire. So they said, well, we don't want to put astronauts in this at first. Let's put Homer and some of the engineers. And we're going, well, I don't. Okay. All right. So we thought the odds were pretty good. So we went in and we tested it. We didn't catch on fire. So that's how we, that and Story and all the rest of them came up and got in their seats.
That's funny.
Well, we did hours and hours of testing underwater and it went up and they fixed it. They sure did.
Wow, that's incredible. That's funny. As you look back on your NASA career, Homer, is there a particular moment or mission that stands out for you specifically?
Well, naturally, the Space Lab J. I loved working over in Japan and getting to know the Japanese people. And that was such a great adventure over there. And so that was really the high point, I think. And then seeing that fly, Mae Jemison, the first Black woman astronaut, was part of Space Lab J. So I got to be really, really good friends with Mae and still am. And then along came Hubble, and Hubble was very special to me. And then the International Space Station, where I was sent over to Japan with the team to negotiate with the Russians on the International Space Station. And they had not too long before that, the whole Soviet Union had collapsed, and they were a pretty poor outfit. And I looked across the table, and we were all relative. I was probably the oldest one at that time. So that had been about 1996, and I was 50 years old or so. And I was probably the oldest one, the NASA team. The rest of them were just children of 20s, you know. And all the Apollo guys, all those guys, they had long since retired. They weren't with it. But sitting across the table from me were the same bunch that had launched Sputnik.
Wow.
The same time. Oh, man. And it's like, well, you know, and so the Russians never agreed to anything at the negotiating table. Take heed, American State Department. And where they do agree is at the party that's after every meeting. Doesn't matter when the meeting's over. It could be over at 10 o'clock in the morning. They have a party. And so the vodka starts flowing, but where you make progress with the Russians. And so I started talking about when I was a kid in Colwood, West Virginia, and how Sputnik had so inspired me and a whole generation. And these guys knew nothing about that, nothing.
Hmm.
And they got to like me, and they started to do what I was negotiating with them was how we were going to train their cosmonauts, how they were going to train our astronauts, you know, whether we'd be flying back and forth that much. And I was trying to hold that to a minimum, all the flying back and forth. Anyway, so because of that, they liked me and they agreed to a lot of things maybe they wouldn't have agreed to. I don't know. But they did ask me if I wanted to see Sputnik. And I said, I saw it. I saw it in 1957. They said, you'd like to see it again? I'm going, yeah, but I know it burned up in a couple of months after that. And they said, well, we built two, you know, and you want to see the other one that we might have picked to fly? And I went, well, yeah. And so they took me to a warehouse, and right now that's in a museum now, but at that time it was just an old warehouse, and opened it up and there was Sputnik. Could have been D1. And I'm looking at it and saying, well, thank you. Thank you, Jesus. So there I was, that Colwood boy. I actually got to see Sputnik twice. What do you know?
That must have been a surreal sort of full circle moment for you.
Yeah, I was like, okay, so lightning's going to hit me and kill me now, right? So I've got my story full circle. But that was a little bit longer anyway.
I'd love to discuss writing with you. You told Nicholas Dinos back in 2008 that you didn't have to be a space engineer, but you did have to be a writer. I'm a writer as well. I don't know if you call me successful, but I'm more successful than I ever thought I would be. So that must be something. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. What does writing mean to you, Homer?
Well, Josh, it was just always inside of me, but I wanted to be a writer. I started reading when I was like 4 years old, and I just absorbed all these stories. Plus, I was surrounded by storytellers there in West Virginia who knew how to tell a story, beginning, middle, end. You know, that's kind of necessary. A lot of writers forget that. So I was kind of infused with all this, without even realizing it, this desire to emulate the writers in these various books that I read, and plus being able to tell a story. And so I just had this feeling that I wanted to write. I wrote first short stories back in the third grade, and my teacher liked it enough that she mimeographed them and carried them around to the junior high school and so on. And then later became a writer for the school newspaper at Virginia Tech. I had a kind of a popular column that I wrote there. And when I came back from Vietnam, I realized that, well, I had an engineering degree, but I needed to go to work. I needed to make some money. You know, I need to live. But what I really, really missed was writing and didn't know what to write about or if I was even capable. At that time, there were, however, a lot more openings, I think, for freelance writers, and that there were just literally hundreds and hundreds of magazines about any subject you could think of. And so I started scuba diving and reading a lot of these scuba diving magazines and looking at them. I can write, you know, as well as these writers. And so that's how I really started cutting my teeth on writing, was to write about diving on shipwrecks. I became kind of a shipwreck diving specialist for these various magazines, and it fulfilled a great need within me. I needed to write. And so I guess I didn't have to be a space engineer or any kind of engineer, although Virginia Tech did a good job of pounding it in my head, you know, out of me. So I had that capability, and people actually wanted to pay me for it, you know, which was good. But I started making a little bit of money freelance writing, you know, it was nickel words, something like that. But I honed my craft. I paid my dues, learning how to interest an editor, you know, in the very first sentence or two about what article I wanted to write, and then to get the assignment and then actually do the writing and doing all that back and forth. Everything was done by mail back then. And so, you know, going out and staring at your mailbox and hoping that you get, you know, at least a rejection letter, get something. You know, so, but I happened upon this topic of the U-boat wars along the East Coast, which virtually nothing had been written about it that was of interest. And I knew that I had a special story there, and I had developed the skill at that time from all this other freelance writing that I was doing, I felt, to put this book together. And so that turned out to work really well. Naval Institute Press, by the way, an insurance broker, read a lot of my stuff about shipwrecks and diving on German U-boat wrecks. And this insurance broker up in Maryland, this was in the 80s, wrote to me and asked if he could ask me about submarines. And I wrote back and I said, sure. And he started calling me, and he really bugged me a lot. And I just realized after a while he was just trying to steal my stuff. But I did the best I could for him. And by the way, his name was Tom Clancy.
So, no kidding.
No kidding. Next thing I knew, Tom Clancy had written The Hunt for Red October about a submarine and was selling about 1 billion copies of it. And so I turned the tables on old Tom and said, hey, Tom, I got this book that I'm writing called Torpedo Junction 8. And the first publisher was Naval Institute Press. So that turned out to be my first publisher too, was Naval Institute Press. So what do you know?
Well, you know, that's incredible. So what was it that made you decide to actually sit down and write Rocket Boys?
Yeah. So again, after Torpedo Junction came out, and that'd taken over a decade of really, really deep research and a lot of writing and revision and so on to make it publishable, I kind of felt like that was the book that I was meant to write. And so I got really, really busy with NASA, with Spacelab J and the space station, Hubble, everything else. But so I just never figured I was going to write another book, but I still wanted to write. So I was continuing to freelance. And one of the magazines I was writing for, freelancing for, was Smithsonian Air and Space Magazine. And they liked my stuff. And so one night, I think it was 94, Pat Trenner, who was the editor of Smithsonian, called me and asked me for 2,000 words on anything I wanted to write about. And I looked across at my desk, and there sat the only artifact I had left when I was a rocket boy in Colwood, was a perfectly crafted steel De La Valle rocket nozzle I was using for a paperweight. I don't know what, something just clicked in my head. And I said, Pat, I could write you 2,000 words on when I was a kid in West Virginia and I built rockets. And she was, I have to tell you, was completely, totally, utterly underwhelmed with this idea. But I did it anyway. And they loved it. Pat loved it and asked for pictures or anything that I had. And so they kind of puffed it up a little bit, made it into a major article. And my phone just started to ring from New York publishers and Hollywood, you know, asking me if I was going to write a book about this. And at that time, memoirs were suddenly hot. Angela's Ashes had just come out. And it's like, okay, this whole new genre was kind of opening up. What is a memoir? It's not an autobiography. It's something else. It is the truth written in the style of a novel. And you're able to move the action scenes around a little bit. You're able to have composite characters. You're able to do things that most people hadn't thought about doing. You know, To Kill a Mockingbird, in a way, is a memoir, but she fictionalized the whole thing. You know, everything was fictionalized. Right. But with this memoir, this was something new. And so that's what I decided to do, was to get in and write a memoir. Now, how to write a memoir? Nobody hardly knew how to do it. I could go look at Angel's Ashes and To Kill a Mockingbird. I look at some of the other things and just get an idea. My first idea was to write it as if I was at NASA, reminiscing, looking back, tell about some of the things that were happening at NASA. But that didn't work. I was well into this, and I just had to recognize it didn't work. What I finally decided was it just had to be told using the voice of that boy, little Sonny Hickam, 14 through 17 year old. He needed to tell the story to make it real. And so that meant that I had to do something I really, really did not want to do. And that was to go back and be that boy. Mm-hmm. And I like to say I got $1 million worth of psychotherapy I didn't even know I needed.
Rocket boy.
Because I did have to get, he didn't know anything that was going to happen. He knew nothing that was going to happen. And so all he knew was what was happening. And so I had to get in there and be him, or let him tell the story. And that wasn't easy, I got to tell you. But it worked.
Yeah, it worked very well. It was a huge bestseller. Were you surprised by how warmly it was received?
Yes and no. As soon as I started writing it and letting people know about some of the chapters, I got a really high power, two really high powered agents that were very interested in it. Mickey Freiberg in Hollywood recognized immediately that this was potentially a movie. And then Frank Wyman, literary agent in New York, they were both very, very, they teamed together on this. So ultimately, they got me a really good publisher, Random House, Delacorte, Bam Doubleday Dale. They got lots of names, but you know who they are. They're big guys. And sure. So I started writing it, and it was clear that they thought it was going to be a bestseller. And then Universal Studios came along. Chuck Gordon, producer there, they bought the rights to it well before it was written, completely written. And so I was sending chapters out to them while they were developing the screenplday. So it was kind of interesting to all that. That's one of the reasons why the movie doesn't exactly match the books, because I changed a few things, but they already had an idea for some of these earlier chapters, what they wanted to do. So yeah, it wasn't quite that much of a surprise, but it was very gratifying. And then of course, after that, the publishers were interested in whatever I wanted to write. And I continued to write some memoirs, but I decided that I wanted to write some other things. I wrote some historical fiction set during World War II using all the research I'd done for Torpedo Junction, the Josh Thurlow series. And I got really interested in paleontology. And so I wrote a novel called The Dinosaur Hunter, which did pretty well. And probably the book that has done next to best to Rocket Boys was a novel memoir, if you will, called Carrying Albert Home. And it's a family tall tale of my mom's pet alligator and how she and my future dad back in the 1930s carried this pet alligator back to Florida. And growing up, they told me all these tales about, you couldn't name any place between Colwood and Key West that they hadn't been carrying this alligator home. So that turned out to be a real popular book. So I just really enjoy writing still. As a matter of fact, today we're going to have a table read of a screenplay that I've written based upon the Colwood Way, which is another Rocket Boy story, Christmas story, that I'm calling December Sky. So it's exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, you never know. When it comes to Hollywood, I'll believe it when I sit down in the theater seat with popcorn in my hand. But it's fun to work with the folks out there. And it's really kind of fun to kind of stretch my writing ability to include screenplay writing. So I've had a little fun with that.
It's writing. It's something you do. It's something you are, not something you do, right?
I agree with that totally. You know, I mean, the writers, I've had so many people tell me that they wanted to write. And I'm going, well, why aren't you writing?
A writer writes. Yeah.
You know, what's wrong with you? And I want to take a class. I want to do that. No, sit down and start to write. And honestly, what I've found with new writers where they kind of fail is they just get completely hooked on a story. And especially when you're writing book length, and they get hooked on the story that they want to write about. And they spend years and years and years and years, and they just can't make it work. And for whatever reason, and I go, you know, you need to go on. I mean, it's fine to come back to it, but honestly, you have learned so much writing this that you probably don't even know what you've learned. And so it's usually the second book for an author that works and gets published and they get to be known for. Well, I did have that first book published. It did well, but I wasn't known for it. The Rocket Boys, and the second book was the one that I had the ability then to write that book.
Yeah, it's interesting. You echo some advice that I've given in the past to, you know, the few times people have asked me, a writer writes. I have a friend who desperately wants to be a science fiction writer. And every time we go out, he's like, you know, Josh, you're doing this and you're doing that. And it's really cool. I want to get my own stuff up off the ground. And I'll ask the obvious question, well, you know, what are you working on? And a writer writes. And I still don't quite understand why it's such a difficult concept.
Well, I think I know a little bit. And that is that I think new writers start thinking about the story and the plot. And that becomes their kind of the focus and how to make that work. But as soon as they start writing, it's about a person, a character. In fact, what people are really interested in is other people. And so it doesn't matter what the plot is. If you can make your characters interesting and write it in such a way people want to turn the page to see what's going to happen to those characters or that main character, then you're going to succeed. But if you just focus on the mechanics of the plot, then it doesn't matter what it is or how outlandish it is or how interesting you think it is. If people don't care about your characters, they're not going to read this book.
Yep.
So it's difficult to, with your little fingers here on a keyboard, to make a person, you know?
Yeah.
And make that a person that you care enough about to take your time to actually scan this ink that's spread around on this page and have that person inhabit your brain and make you want to turn the page to see what's going to happen. And you know this, Josh, unfortunately, as you become a writer, in some ways, reading is spoiled for you.
Yes. You're right.
So you start reading and it's like, it's not the way I would have done it. You know, too many words, you know.
you become very snobbish very quickly.
Yeah, you do. You really do. And it's like, but sometimes I find myself like 10 pages in and I haven't thought like a writer. And I'm going, I stop. And I go, wait a minute. What did this writer do? How did this writer immerse me into this story? Then I'll get mechanical and I'll go back and so I'm always learning. Writers, you have to learn. You can't just be stuck in a rut and always write one way.
Yeah, absolutely. Paying attention to our time here, Homer, I have maybe just a couple questions left. Is that okay? I know we're barked up against our time a little bit. Okay. I appreciate that, Homer. It's a real pleasure to speak with you.
You can edit me down. I'm thoroughly editable.
So I am curious. I don't think I've asked you this yet, Homer, regarding October Sky. Do you think the movie adequately captured what it was like for you during that time? You know, how you interacted with, you know, your teachers. Obviously, the relationship with your father in the movie is doted upon quite a bit. Do you feel it was accurate, fair representation?
Well, yeah. Again, I'll put in another plug for the latest memoir called Don't Blow Yourself Up. And I write about how I ended up writing Rocket Boys and then how the movie was made and how I was on set quite a lot and how gracious Chuck Gordon, the producer, and Joe Johnston, the director, was to allow me to be on set. And, you know, I had a number of suggestions. And one day, Joe Johnston sat me down and said at lunch, and I was going on about, well, you know, that's not the way I wrote it in a book. And I think it'd be better, you know, this way. And he was going, you know, Homer, we're just trying to sell popcorn here, don't you? Do you realize that? Like, you're right. I get it. And so it's a different art form from a book. So you've only got an hour to 2 hours or so to tell this story. And you've got all these people and all these machines and all this stuff that has to be brought in to tell this story. It has to be done in an efficient way. It has to be done some way so it doesn't cost $1 billion to do. You've got a budget and so on. So how do you tell this story? So again, so that somebody sits there in a darkened theater these days in the living room with the cat meowing and, you know, all that. But make it a story again where it's about people that you are interested in and you want to hear about these people or watch these people. So yeah, it's a different art form. So I had a few problems. I didn't like the fact they called my dad John. I'm a junior, Homer Jr. I was called Sonny growing up. I didn't like that, but you know, you just have to go with it. And my mom didn't care. So I said, well, why should I care? Dad had passed away by then. So it's what they wanted to do. So, okay, you kind of give in on certain things. But other than that, I thought they captured certainly the atmosphere of the town very well. And that boy, and Jake Gyllenhaal did a fantastic job with that boy and the other actors for the other boys. And Chris Cooper, as my dad, did a fantastic job. Natalie Kennedy playing my mom and Laura Dern playing Miss Riley. They all did a wonderful job. So I have no complaints about the movie. Sold a lot of books, by the way.
Sure did. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Homer, you know, you've been interviewed so many times by people, you know, better looking and more intelligent than me, right?
No, it's the first time. This is the most intelligent interview I've ever had.
Oh,
the most handsome guy that I've ever heard.
Well, I can see the check cleared. But, you know, I'm curious if there's a question that hasn't been asked of you that you wish someone would ask.
Not really, Josh. You know, I kind of like to go with the flow of the interview, and this has been a great interview.
Oh.
And so I really just can't say that there's, I mean, of course, naturally, I would really prefer that they mention my website, homerhickam.com, a lot more than perhaps they did. But ultimately, we write to be read, right? So
yep.
That's what we do. But no, I've been graced by great interviewers who love this story. And so, no, it's very good. And your questions today have been spot on. I appreciate it.
That's very kind of you to say, Homer. I appreciate you saying that. Well, then we'll leave it with just the last one. Homer Hickam, how can people find out about you, sir?
Did I just mention my website, homerhickam.com? You have to know how to spell Hickam, though. It's H-I-C-K-A-M, homerhickam.com. And there you can see all of my books. And if you want to order one up, an autographed copy, then just get in touch with us through the website.
Excellent. Homer Hickam, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time for me. It meant a lot.
You're more than welcome, Josh. Thank you.
All right. You take care.
You too.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.